humanoid, somehow chubby and shredded. Genie, allegedly. My man Will Smith be looking like a deformed Teletubby, commented Big Bag. The reaction was harsh. Smith was clowned for days, and the film became a token of Disney's rapacious drive to live-actionize everything in its repertoire. Our three wishes are all for Will Smith's genie in Aladdin to go away, Vice opined. The second episode was worse. In April, Paramount released its Sonic the Hedgehog trailer, and when audiences saw that the filmmakers overhauled Sonic's physique to give him a more human shape, they erupted. The criticism was so loud, Paramount agreed to a redesign of the character. Thank you for the support and the criticism, tweeted director Jeff Fowler. The message is loud and clear. You aren't happy with the design and you want changes. It's going to happen. It's a move that cost Paramount millions while logging millions of views for YouTubers who made fun of the trailer in ever more creative ways. I didn't think the Cats trailer would get the same backlash as Sonic or Aladdin, but they were important analogs. All these things, the dislike-to-like ratio, the comments, the tweets, the articles, the examples of Sonic and Aladdin, were reference points. They helped me understand what the internet thought and what the internet would like me to think. I Googled Cats to confirm my sense of the situation. I don't know why you're all freaking out over miniature yet huge cats with human celebrity faces and sexy breasts performing a demented dream ballet for kids, tweeted Louis Vertel. Next, the top stories side scroll. The Cats trailer is here, and it's horrifying the internet, reported CNN. These days, you find a lot of headlines referring to the internet as a monolith, a collective mind. It's the same with Twitter. Twitter thinks, Twitter rages, Twitter is sad, confused, gives condolences. Boston Globe. Cats trailer unites internet in abject terror. The Week. Downright nightmarish Cats trailer stuns critics. My eyes are bleeding. AV Club. Your eyeballs are not ready for the horrors within the Cats trailer. The Atlantic. I watched the Cats trailer, and I have some questions. BuzzFeed. Here are the funniest tweets about the new Cats trailer. Salon. Why do the cats in Cats look like medieval art gone wrong? And other burning questions. L. The five stages of dealing with the Cats trailer. Wired. A feline anatomy expert weighs in on that Cats trailer. Some headlines were creative, most recycled old language. Together, they broadcast a subtle opinion about the situation. It was relieving that this opinion matched my expectation, though I should have guessed that people were going to swap the trailer audio for music from actual horror movies. Arguably the most popular thing to come out of the first day of Cats commentary was Ian Abramson's mashup of Cats with the song from Jordan Peele's Us trailer. The unsettling remix of I Got Five on It by Loonies fit like a glove. The next day, BuzzFeed caught up with Abramson to discuss. When something like this happens on the internet, it feels like a gift, Abramson said, that we can get something so completely batshit crazy that wasn't trying to be. BuzzFeed reports that the LA-based comedian noticed people comparing the film online to a horror movie when he came up with the idea. Abramson saw what we wanted, and he spoke for us. AV Club. This Cats Us trailer mashup is hideously perfect. Insider. Someone put the creepy music from Us over the new Cats trailer, and people think it's much more fitting. Then Jordan Peele quote-tweeted Abramson, adding, yes. Entertainment Weekly. Jordan Peele agrees. Cats trailer fits better with the song from Us. What I read helped me understand what we thought. The vitriol was pretty light, as I imagined it would be. In fact, even before the close of the first day, a counter-movement of support had begun to form. "The Cats movie musical trailer looks great," Slate's Marissa Martinelli wrote, "whatever the haters say." NBC News' Mara Johnston was won over by Jennifer Hudson's rendition of Memory, the show's biggest tune. She got the sort of chill that only a tour de force performance of classic Broadway schmaltz could. Theater fans, it seems to me, are more forgiving than society at large, especially for eccentric displays of sentimentality. Would they adopt this misfit project as their own? Others predicted box office success, despite the VFX snafu. Scott Mendelson from Forbes was the first to advance this view. "Cats, with a perfectly bonkers trailer, Universal has no cause for alarm." Despite social media's mocking, Mendelson believed Cats was positioning itself as the big musical of Christmas 2019, which means it will likely print enough money to fill all the world's litter boxes, and then some. He drew on the track record of recent musical hits like Tom Hooper's earlier film, Les Miserables, which grossed $422 million worldwide, and 2017's The Greatest Showman, which did abysmally on opening weekend, only to slow burn to over $430 million, plus much more from its wildly popular soundtrack. Theater geeks tilt scales. With all that info, I was able to categorize our reaction to the Cats trailer alongside similar reactions to Sonic the Hedgehog and Aladdin, but with subtle variations due to its proximity to theater culture. As time went on, I'd be able to refine that judgment. The internet's feelings are complex, but not infinitely varied. The more you consume the flows of tweets, videos, articles, comments, the easier it gets to bracket that complexity and understand its outer limits. And when you understand what the internet thinks, you understand what it's okay to say. And when you understand what it's okay to say, you can add your part to the symphony. You can collect your likes. You can smother incompatible views. Or you can just watch and let the internet flow through you. And let the internet become you. I wrote the proceeding a day after the Cats trailer came out, attempting to recount my thinking in the hour after I watched it. I wondered then, and still wonder, was it really my thinking, or was the internet thinking through me? Of course, this is a ridiculous example. I spent an hour of my life absorbing the discourse around the fucking Cats trailer. Is there anything more fleeting, more insignificant than that? I doubt it. But when I look back on my internet consumption, I'm forced to admit that a shamefully big part of it is comprised of 5-minute or 10-minute or hour-long chunks devoted to fleeting and insignificant things. Maybe you know what I mean. We all understand that the internet excels at capturing attention. Alerts, notifications, clickbait, the recommended tabs, the automatic next episode. But what happens to our attention once it's captured? Are we really engaging with the content we're served? Do we exist at all in these rabbit holes and time sucks? Increasingly, it feels less like I'm using my mind online and more like my mind is being used, channeled, like I'm a medium for some vast foreign spirit. What I wrote in 2019, that hour after the Cats trailer, reads like the record of an absurd seance. I am not there at all. To the internet, I'm just another device. My mind plays the content it supplies me, and when that content plays, I disappear. So much web surfing is passive. Even things that are technically active, scrolling, clicking, liking, searching, take on a passive quality. Ever involuntarily open a new tab and type Facebook into the search bar? Sometimes I notice 3 tabs of the New York Times open and wonder when I did that, how I did it, without realizing. Even as I followed the thread of Kat's commentary, checking tweets, reading headlines, cross-referencing videos, seeking a consensus, it felt like viewing, not doing, like floating downstream. If I raised up out of myself, I would have seen a hunched body with glazed eyes reflecting a scrolling newsfeed. It's an image out of science fiction. It's the Matrix, those people in their pods of pink goo, hooked up by wires to power stations where machines harvest their body heat for energy. Only there are no wires in our version, and the machines are controlled, for now, by profit-seeking humans, and they don't want our heat, they want our attention and money. Not all content consumption is passive. Good books, films, journalism, videos, podcasts, etc. encourage you to think critically. When you've finished a book or an album, there should be a period of time for you to reflect on what you've experienced. You should have a break to let your mind wander, to examine your response, to write your thoughts down, to discuss them with others. That's one reason I love seeing movies at the theater. We talk about preserving the communal experience of watching movies, but what about when the movie ends, that ritual of slowly getting up, emerging into the lobby, and waiting until someone finally says, "So what did you think?" The conversation that follows, in the car ride home or over drinks at a bar, is what makes the passive viewing experience active. The internet isn't interested in those gaps, those moments of reflection or conversation. It wants all your moments. As soon as you're done with one thing, it brings you without delay to the next. Even as you're watching something, the user interface lays out a menu of possible next things in a sidebar so it can siphon off a little of your focus. Or it just plays that thing automatically. Netflix's autoplay is the equivalent of putting a six-pack on an alcoholic's kitchen counter. You could stop yourself, but they're making it so easy not to. The modern world obliterates restraint. The internet obliterates the time between experiences. Netflix CEO Reed Hastings tipped his hat to this idea in 2017, declaring, "We are really competing with sleep on the margin. Every minute of waking life," he assumes, "is conquerable. The final frontier are those 8 hours of slumber." Why does it have to be 8? Surely Netflix can carve off 1 or 2 for itself. You get a show or a movie you're really dying to watch, and you end up staying up late at night, Hastings told Summit LA 17. So we actually compete with sleep, and we're winning. Those of us who routinely binge into the wee hours agree. With breaks between things erased, web surfing becomes a different experience than other forms of media consumption. It's passive, but it's also self-dissolving. The subject doing the surfing is replaced temporarily by the internet's programmed rhythms. When you glance at the clock to see 2 hours have evaporated, this, I believe, is what happened. As for why it happens, I think that has to do with how the human mind functions. When I was an undergrad at Boston University, I studied with Leah Greenfeld, a sociology professor and renowned historian of nationalism. She was one of a handful of teachers in my life who really had an impact on me, who helped me to look at the world in fresh ways. When I took her course in 2010, she was nearing the completion of an ambitious book about mental illness called Mind, Modernity, Madness: The Impact of Culture on Human Experience. In class, we read the manuscript together, then discussed in detail her theories and arguments. She used us as whetstones, inviting us to challenge any idea in an effort to make the book sharper. It was my final year of schooling, but the first time I felt like I was actually contributing to something. In 2013, Professor Greenfeld published Mind Modernity Madness to acclaim. I recommend it, even if you aren't interested in mental health. It's painstakingly researched but incredibly readable, and her theory of mental illness is derived from more fundamental theories of culture and the mind, which have all kinds of interesting applications to other fields. In fact, that was our final assignment, to apply Professor Greenfeld's theories to a subject of our choosing. At the time, suffering from senioritis, I didn't make much of an effort, handing in a lackluster paper on God knows what. But the ideas stuck in my head, and I think her theory of mind, specifically, is useful for understanding the role of the internet in our lives. Maybe she'll consider amending my grade. For Greenfeld, the brain and the mind are different things, connected but not the same. Almost all animals have brains. They collect information from the senses, then coordinate activity based on that info. Brains enable a being to read signs. The environment is constantly signifying to the animal brain, and the animal reacts with behaviors coded into their DNA by thousands of years of evolution. A whiff of odor signifies the presence of a prowling lioness or leopard to the gazelle, writes Greenfeld. It utters a cry, which signifies it to others in the herd, and they spring into flight. Being animals ourselves, the world signifies to us too, and we can read signs with the best of our animal cousins. But the mental life of humans is exponentially more complex than that of even the smartest non-human animals. As a result, we became the dominant species on Earth. What accounts for this difference? Is it the size of our brains? Greenfeld doesn't think so. Human consciousness is unique, she argues, because it exists not only within the reality of signs, but also within the reality of symbols. Signs correspond to stimuli in the world and predetermined behaviors. When the gazelle smells the leopard, it has no choice but to run. The sign triggers the reaction. The meaning of symbols, on the other hand, are invented, intentional, and they get their significance from the historical context in which they're used. What enabled the creation of symbols was not just the large human brain, Greenfeld says, but the larynx, what we call the voice box, a small organ in the top of the neck that lets us manipulate sound with far more nuance than other animals. At some unknowable point in our evolutionary past, early Homo sapiens realized that they could create sounds that had no intrinsic meaning aside from the meaning they chose to give it at that specific point in time. They created words, and words generate more words until a whole system of symbols emerges, a language. Unlike our ability to read and react to signs, language isn't encoded into our DNA. We don't pass it down genetically, but we do pass it down. Since the invention of language, humans have been born into an elaborate symbolic reality. Almost all of this reality was created by those who came before, but it never ceases to evolve, and every new person can change it. This symbolic reality is what we mean when we use the word culture. When a child enters the culture by acquiring language, her mind is born. It's a feedback loop. The mind creates culture, and culture creates each new mind. The brain makes both possible, but culture and mind are not material like the brain. They create material byproducts like books and rockets and iPhones, but there is no material aspect to their actual happening. As Greenfeld explains, and this is the crucial point, the mind is a process, a function of time. Just like language and culture, we can't know what a word means unless you specify when it's being used. The meanings of words change, sometimes dramatically, over time. Similarly, to understand the value of anything in culture, we have to put it in temporal context. It's the same with us. We remember into the past, hope into the future, we see ourselves through a temporal lens. I am not who I was back then, we say. I'm different now. Think about it. There is no physicality to our thoughts. They don't take up space, even if we sometimes use that metaphor to describe them. Thoughts happen in sequence, in time. Greenfeld's theory of mind casts our internet addictions in a different light. When we give away time, it applies, we give away ourselves. When we spend hours scrolling Facebook, we are literally swapping our own thoughts for the feeds. In fact, through the lens of this theory, much of the social internet starts to resemble a human mind. For what is a mind if not a timeline? In the timelines of Facebook, TikTok, Snapchat, I see approximations of mental life, columns of posts ordered by when they were published, meant to be read, seen, or watched in sequence. In Twitter, I see the closest approximation of all, a simple timeline of posts in the dominant symbolic system of language, each as brief as a thought. Tweets look like thoughts, don't they? They're short, fragmentary, often poorly considered, sometimes funny, sometimes nonsensical, usually suffused with emotion. They come and go quickly as whims, flitting down the timeline, always yielding to the next and the next. You can have your own thoughts while reading Twitter, but why bother? The other thing Greenfeld's theory implies is that the border between culture and individual minds is porous. We're already thinking with a language we didn't invent, with knowledge we didn't generate, with conventional wisdom established long before we were born. How many of our ideas are original? How many are influenced by our parents, by what we've read, by what our parents read? Culture is always in the mind, and the internet is just an expression of culture. An internet seance like the Cats one I recorded in 2019 is an extension of ordinary thinking. It's how much of an extension that troubles me. Culture guides us, but there is such a thing as agency. Individuals get their symbols from culture, but we can choose how to put them together. That's the work of thinking, the source of new ideas on which an evolving culture depends. Every mind can add to the symbolic commonwealth. When I'm consuming the internet, it feels like the agency dial has been turned to zero. Culture isn't just in my mind, it's steering my thinking. I'm no longer the one putting the symbols together. Twitter's algorithm is doing it for me, or Facebook's, or Google's. And as I spend more time online, I'm getting better at ascertaining the internet's opinions instead of developing my own. That's what I was doing with the Cats trailer, scouring the web like an investigative reporter, trying to piece together the opinions of other people. So I could, what, adopt those opinions? Parrot those opinions when someone eventually asked me what I thought about the trailer? Or was I doing it because, well, that's just what we do on social media? After I watch a YouTube video or see an Instagram post, I instinctively scroll to the comments to see what others think. The number of likes and dislikes offers me a ready-made judgment. When you're moving hurriedly from post to post, those judgments are handy, until you reach the end of the day and realize they comprise most of your point of view. You lie in bed and wonder, what do I think? But then you doze off. Don't get me wrong. You can learn a lot on the internet. You can learn more than at any previous time in history. But ingesting information is only half of learning. The other half, the more important half, is responding to that information, thinking critically about it, about what it implies. Does it fit with your worldview? If not, why not? This is the part of learning that turns knowledge into wisdom, into action. This is the part of learning through which you create yourself, and it demands mental free time, time when you're not consuming media of any kind, when you're doing nothing at all. By greedily claiming every appointment on your mind's timeline, the internet erases these vital hours from your life. I learned this lesson making The Nerd Writer. Over the last decade, I've produced about 250 episodes of my YouTube series. Writing the show can be difficult, editing is time-consuming, but my biggest obstacle has always been coming up with original ideas. For years, my instinct was to scour the internet for something noteworthy and exclusive, something that struck a chord with me. I'd read for hours and hours, but then I'd come to the end of the day and have nothing to show for it, aside from irritated eyes and a mild headache. A week might pass like this. I'd get so frustrated that I'd give up, go for lunch, take a walk, do the laundry I'd been putting off, then bam, while I was folding a piece of underwear, listening to some Jesse Ware, an idea would appear. It took me way too long to realize what you can no doubt already see. I needed to include free time, nothing time, in this period of ideation. Research is important, but constantly being an input is not conducive to invention. I needed to let my mind do its thing. And the mind will, if you let it. Weird things, impressive things, scary things. When was the last time you sat facing a window for 45 minutes? It's tougher than it sounds. Whenever I try it, I sit there for what feels like 2 hours, only to glance at the clock to see 6 minutes have passed. Nothing time runs at a snail's pace, at least 1/10 the rate of Twitter time and 1/30 the rate of TikTok time. And your mind doesn't always wander where you want it to. Often, it wanders right into your anxieties, that mirror maze in the basement of your personality. Once I began to carve out time for doing nothing, I found myself in that maze a lot. It's an uncomfortable place to be. So many years with instant access to distraction crippled the natural defenses I had to deal with that stuff, to process it. You have to be prepared to withstand a good amount of self-punishment if you want to reclaim time for yourself. But the rewards are worth it, and not just for those who work in the creative arts. All work benefits from fresh thinking. Personal growth depends on new ideas. The internet of today, designed to make you a permanent input, does more than just steal time from you. It erodes your agency and substitutes internet awareness for self-awareness. Those are the three things, time, agency, and self-awareness, that we use to construct our identities. Without them, sense of self weakens, identity destabilizes, and the result is what we see in the research and feel in ourselves. Stress, anxiety, or worse. Despite awareness of the problem, despite constant media coverage, despite all the tortured PR from tech companies, I don't expect any real change to the time-eating incentive structure of the internet in the near term. Maybe I'm just a pessimist. Maybe the backlash to big tech's invasive practices will translate into action sooner than later. You can already hear the rumbling of a political coalition that cuts across party lines on this issue. And there are some impressive people out there sitting silently in front of their windows, imagining new ways to design the internet business model, to break social media's addiction to our addiction. But the gap between awareness and change is vast. A little less than a month ago, when I began writing this essay, I was earnestly committed to cutting down my tech use. I trapped my iPhone in the closet and checked for messages only once or twice per day, never bringing it into the bedroom. I deleted all the social media apps. I sat dutifully in my chair each morning and watched cars go by, letting my insecurities batter me. It wasn't fun, but it let up after a while. I had some good ideas, did some productive work. My mind felt quiet. It felt like mine. A month later, and that's all out the window. My iPhone is right here, next to my laptop. I check it once a minute, give or take. It sleeps beside me on my nightstand, and I open it immediately upon waking. All those apps have been re-downloaded. My screen time graph looks like a giant U with new peaks threatening to exceed the old ones. Sunday at 9 a.m. is once again the hour of shame. Work continues because it has to, but I'm far less productive. Anyone who's tried to confront their internet addiction will be familiar with this kind of backsliding. I can't even recall what broke my good habits or when it happened. It snuck up on me. Now I have to regroup. I have to put those safeguards back in place to retake control of my mind. But I don't have to do that yet, do I? No, not yet. The comforts of cyberpunk. About 35 minutes into Blade Runner, there's a short scene in which Rick Deckard, a recently unretired cop who hunts and kills rogue androids, takes a glass of whiskey onto the terrace of his apartment, 97 floors above the ground. The camera shows the terrace in profile, and behind it, a monstrous, kaleidoscopic city of the future. Flying cars, neon ads, a billion glittering lights. Deckard shivers under the blanket on his shoulders, drinks. Vangelis's score pulses to life. The impression is one of deep alienation and loneliness, of a little man in his little box in a city full of an infinite number of the same. To me, it feels comforting. That's a peculiar response to Blade Runner, I know. Maybe even a little concerning. Comfort doesn't go with dystopia. A comfortable dystopia is an oxymoron, a dystopia that's not doing its job right. What about this bleak vision of a cyberpunk Los Angeles could possibly be desirable to me? And not only me. As a subgenre and an aesthetic, cyberpunk has proven to be enduringly desirable. Blade Runner premiered in 1982, 40 years ago. The future it depicts is now in our past. Like the original cyberpunk novels, which debuted around the same time, Blade Runner is unmistakably 80s in spirit, reacting to the conditions of that era, extrapolating its future from the tech and politics of the time. Four decades removed, we're still making cyberpunk art in the same spirit. And I don't just mean the 2017 Blade Runner sequel, Blade Runner 2049. Think of Duncan Jones's 2018 film, Mute, or Lisa Joy's Reminiscence from 2021, or the recent Netflix series Altered Carbon, based on the 2002 cyberpunk novel by Richard K. Morgan. These are not small projects. Altered Carbon reportedly costs $7 million per episode, while Blade Runner 2049 was somewhere in the ballpark of $185 million. If studios are willing to hand over that much cash for cyberpunk entertainment, they must believe there's broad demand for it. And if movies, television, and books aren't immersive enough for you, no worries. In late 2020, CD Projekt Red released Cyberpunk 2077, a vast open-world video game where you can explore the seedy yet vibrant Night City as V, a technologically enhanced mercenary who is fully customizable, down to the genitals. Follow the game's branching narrative or cruise Night City at your leisure. If you ever wanted to get lost in a real cyberpunk universe, this game is your ticket. Judging by the tidal wave of pre-orders, it looks like I'm far from the only one who finds this stuff alluring. Footnote: a few months after I wrote this essay, Cyberpunk 2077 had one of the most disastrous game releases in recent memory, due to a variety of glitches and bugs. It was a bummer. Enthusiasm for the game declined rapidly. Even so, the immense excitement ahead of its release speaks to Cyberpunk's enduring appeal. So, what is this stuff, exactly? I've called cyberpunk a subgenre and an aesthetic. I think the latter is easier to identify than the former is to define. That's because cyberpunk has seeded elements of its style into the cultural imagination. I can't walk down a rainy city street at night without feeling like I'm Rick Deckard. Steaming food stalls in crowded open-air markets, dance concerts in old industrial warehouses, the way neon flickers off wet asphalt. Cyberpunk has totally colonized my experience of neon. Scraps of this visual language can be found all across pop culture, from The Matrix and Ghost in the Shell to works less explicitly influenced by the genre, like the recent James Bond movie Skyfall or Coldplay's 2021 music video for Higher Power. Need a gritty urban space of the future? Cyberpunk is your palette. The aesthetic is familiar to the point of cliché. In other words, we know it when we see it. What cyberpunk actually is as a science fiction subgenre and art movement is more complicated. It has roots in the new wave science fiction of the 60s and 70s, in which writers like J.G. Ballard and Michael Moorcock brought experimental ambitions to an often formulaic genre. The new wave reacted against science fiction's golden age, in which heroes wielding shiny gadgets traveled on shiny ships with shiny robots to shiny cities in outer space. Those swashbuckling voyagers lacked psychological depth, they felt. Those techno-utopias lacked political realism. In 1962, Ballard argued for discarding the space story entirely. The biggest developments of the immediate future, he wrote, will take place not on the moon or Mars, but on Earth, and it is inner space, not outer, that needs to be explored. Ballard's inner space was a surreal and scary place, enlarged by the global media network that was beginning to dominate human experience. As Rob Latham points out, New Wave authors engaged with a number of themes, the impacts of new information technologies and the ways a capitalist system might control them, the possibility of uploading consciousness to virtual spaces, the proliferation of synthetic realities and simulated experiences that their cyberpunk successors would take up and synthesize in a new literary movement for a new decade, with a new approach, too. Cyberpunk authors prized the physical. They embedded their ideas in worlds of immense, dusty detail, settings so tactile you can feel the vibrations of off-world ships coming to port in Chiba City, hear the whine of an antique mechanical arm cased in grubby pink plastic. Technology is everywhere in these stories, but it's invasive, malfunctioning, greasy, and that materiality reflects the decade when this fiction emerged. 80s tech sticks to the skin, wrote Bruce Sterling in his preface to the 1986 cyberpunk anthology Mirror Shades. The personal computer, the Sony Walkman, the portable telephone, the soft contact lens. Sterling describes the visceral impression this tech had on his circle of writers and how that prompted the garage band aesthetic of their prose, a style less cultivated, less openly literary than that of their new wave predecessors, but purposefully so. It had a raw quality, like the punk music from which the movement takes half its name. Cyberpunks married a hard SF approach to technology, cyber, with a subcultural perspective, punk, or as Sterling puts it, an unholy alliance of the technical world and the world of organized dissent, the underground world of pop culture, visionary fluidity, and street-level anarchy. Or, more simply, high-tech, low-life. Faceless multinational corporations rule these futures, but the stories take place on the streets in endless urban sprawl, where small-time crooks and marginalized loners repurpose the overflow of tech to make their scores, to sow chaos in virtual systems, or just to get high. Bodies fuse with machines, brains mesh with ports that link them to the other essential backdrop of this subgenre, cyberspace. Cyberspace is a familiar concept now, nearly synonymous with internet, But it wasn't when William Gibson coined the term in 1982 in a short story called Burning Chrome. 2 years later, he defined cyberspace in his debut novel, Neuromancer. A consensual hallucination experienced daily by billions of legitimate operators in every nation, a graphic representation of data abstracted from the banks of every computer in the human system, unthinkable complexity, lines of light ranged in the non-space of the mind, clusters and constellations of data like city lights receding. In Neuromancer, hackers, known as console cowboys, jack into cyberspace and infiltrate the private networks of governments or multinationals, lifting data for cash. The digital space Gibson devised doesn't quite resemble the web of today, but is there a better two-word description for the modern internet than consensual hallucination? Gibson is far from the only important cyberpunk writer. Others from that first wave include Sterling, Rudy Rucker, and Pat Cadigan. But Neuromancer and the sprawl stories that accompany it are quintessential texts. Most of the things we associate with the subgenre, hackers, cyberspace, urban sprawl, body modification, artificial intelligence, neon and neo-noir, alienation and societal decay, can be found in them. In the same way that romantic love can't be defined any more succinctly than Romeo and Juliet, Neuromancer itself is probably the simplest way to define cyberpunk. If someone wants to know what it is, just hand them the book. Or take them to see Blade Runner. If Neuromancer is the quintessential cyberpunk novel, Blade Runner is the quintessential cyberpunk film. I first saw it in college. Since then, I've seen it more times than I can count, in full or in part, to the point where it no longer feels like watching, but tapping in to a familiar texture and rhythm. Extraordinary films transport you into their worlds, but with Ridley Scott's Blade Runner, it was the opposite. The world of the film transported into me. Blade Runner came out 2 years before Neuromancer, but 1 year after Johnny Mnemonic, the first of Gibson's sprawl stories. The two universes don't cover exactly the same ground, but the overlap is uncanny. They both feature anarchic, decadent settings of the future, spilling over with people, tech, and detritus from various eras. The skylines in both are overshadowed by megastructures controlled by mega corporations. They both draw from film noir. Blade Runner is a detective story, and Neuromancer is a heist, and channel its cynical mode. Both star classic noir antiheroes, hard-boiled and burnt-out underlings past their prime. Both examine the nature of humanity through artificial intelligences. Both incorporate Asian influences, the roaring high-tech Tokyo of the 80s, the dense settlements of Kowloon Walled City in Hong Kong. They're both rain-soaked, gripped by unceasing violence, haunted by an overwhelming ennui, awash in neon. Gibson walked out of Blade Runner after 10 minutes. I reeled out of the theater in complete despair over its visual brilliance and its similarity to the look of Neuromancer, my largely unwritten first novel. Not only had I been beaten to the semiotic punch, but this damned movie looked better than the images in my head. After all the work it takes to come up with something original, it must be maddening to find that another artist has arrived at the same place independently. Years later, when Gibson and Scott finally had lunch and compared influences, both acknowledged the debt they owed to Metal Hurlant, a French comics magazine helmed by artist Jean Giraud, better known as Mobius. And if you look at The Long Tomorrow from 1976, a story drawn by Mobius and written by Dan O'Bannon, you can see the first flowering of what would soon become the cluttered cyberpunk aesthetic. Precursors don't stop there, of course. Blade Runner is based on Philip K. Dick's 1968 novel, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, considered by many a proto-cyberpunk work, a designation that also includes William Burroughs's Naked Lunch and Alfred Bester's The Star Is My Destination, as well as movies like Fritz Lang's Metropolis and John Carpenter's Escape from New York. Gibson has cited the hard-boiled detective fiction of Dashiell Hammett, the postmodern satires of Thomas Pynchon, and the disaffected lyrics of Lou Reed as touchstones for Neuromancer. Cyberpunk is built from many parts. It's as much a collage as the cities and people it depicts. In fact, collage is probably its keynote. You can see the urban sites of cyberpunk fiction, the sprawl, Neo-Tokyo, Los Angeles 2019, as physical manifestations of the cut-up technique that William Burroughs pioneered in the 50s and 60s. Burroughs literally cut up passages of prose and pasted them back together at random, creating a collage of strange and often shocking juxtapositions. Look at how he assembles his images in Naked Lunch, the colors and textures, the specificity. We pour it in a Pernod and start for New Orleans past iridescent lakes and orange gas flares and swamps and garbage heaps, alligators crawling around in broken bottles and tin cans, neon arabesques of motels, marooned pimps scream obscenities at passing cars from islands of rubbish. Compare that to Gibson's description of the sprawl in Count Zero. Silent figures sat beside spread blankets as they passed, the blankets arrayed with surreal assortments of merchandise, damp, swollen cardboard covers of black plastic audio discs beside battered prosthetic limbs trailing crude nerve jacks, a dusty glass fishbowl filled with oblong steel dog tags, rubber-banded stacks of faded postcards, cheap Indotrode still sealed in wholesaler's plastic. Cyberpunk cities are vast collages where strange and often shocking juxtapositions await on every corner. The language Gibson uses to describe his fictional metropolis cuts up mundane debris with technospeak, the future folded into the past, and vice versa. Cities are like compost heaps, he told the Paris Review in 2011. Just layers and layers of stuff. In cities, the past and the present and the future can all be totally adjacent. Among other things, Burroughs's disjointed prose aimed to snap people out of conformity. He used the jarring contrasts of collage to short-circuit language's tendency to reproduce oppressive narratives. In his case, the conservative values of post-war America. By the 80s, those values had exploded. But Gibson found this technique useful for different reasons. For him, the hallucinatory mishmash of stuff captured something true about experience in the new information age, the vertigo of accelerating change, the dizzying spectacle of globalized media, the feeling of being drowned in consumer goods with barely a shelf life before obsolescence. Disjointed imagery had power because life was disjointed, and because we were. Maybe that's why these stories comfort me. Cyberpunk turns those messy feelings into a place where it's no longer necessary to resist the splintering pressures of society because the fight's over and we lost. All that's left is to submit to the carnival of sensations. In a cyberpunk future, I can let go. I can melt into the prismatic flux of civilization. There's a relief in that, even a feeling of oneness. Think of the monologue Roy Batty delivers at the end of Blade Runner. Moments before dying, the replicant Batty laments the loss of his unique experiences in the amnesia of time. I've seen things you people wouldn't believe. Attack ships on fire off the shoulder of Orion. I watched sea beams glitter in the dark near the Tannhauser Gate. All those moments will be lost in time, like tears in rain. It's one of the most evocative speeches in film history, made more so by the visual of a rain-soaked Batty and the tears we can't see, underscored by Vangelis's music. It captures existential anxieties we all share. I have a kindred feeling when I look into the night sky. Nothing makes me feel smaller than imagining the space between galaxies, or the time it takes for a star's light to reach my eye. But while there is angst in this line of thinking, there is also a blissful feeling of surrender. Part of me is calmed by my insignificance, by the teardrop of my life being lost in the downpour of time. I feel the same way in big cities, where I can fade into the crowd, into the lights and noise, into sanctioned delirium, as the poet Charles Baudelaire put it. I came across Baudelaire searching for others who share this feeling of surrender, this attraction to cities. He describes something similar in his concept of the flâneur. From the French word for stroller, a flâneur is someone at home in the swarm of city streets. It is an immense joy to set up house in the heart of the multitude, Baudelaire writes, amid the ebb and flow of movement in the midst of the fugitive and the infinite. Baudelaire was the flâneur par excellence of 19th century Paris. As he wandered through arcades, department stores, across wide boulevards lit by gas lamps, observing, vanishing. Baudelaire's flâneur is a figure of thoughtful observation, but one who is also marked by an encroaching loss of self, an I with an insatiable appetite for the non-I. The flâneur is also a product of modernity, a term Baudelaire coined to describe the transient, the fleeting, the contingent experience of life in the 19th century, a transitional period during which the modern metropolis emerged, as well as the unique psychological afflictions it gave rise to. The chaos of urban centers stimulates the nerves to their utmost reactivity, wrote sociologist Georg Simmel in an influential essay from 1903, until they can finally produce no reaction at all. As anyone who's lived in a city will know, it's easy to feel overstimulated, and too much of that feeling can render you numb and disconnected from the people around you, even from yourself. The deep problems of modern life, Simmel wrote, flow from the attempt of the individual to maintain the independence and individuality of his existence against the sovereign powers of the society. If the city dweller fails to do so, they're at risk of being leveled, swallowed up in the social technological mechanism of the metropolis. Simmel and those who came after rightly deemed this potential loss of self a danger, maybe the danger of greater urbanism. A century later, these alienating forces have only grown more severe. Cities got bigger and more complex. Relationships became more impersonal, more mediated by money and technology, more transactional. All along the way, there were theorists analyzing these trends and artists offering poignant portraits of urban alienation. Books like J.D. Salinger's The Catcher in the Rye, movies like Martin Scorsese's Taxi Driver, songs like The Kinks' Waterloo Sunset, paintings like Edward Hopper's Nighthawks. Many of these works present alienation as a psychological rot, and it can certainly be that. The city's special brand of loneliness is often crippling. It can exacerbate antisocial tendencies in a vicious loop, resulting in anxiety, depression, and violence, like Travis Bickle's bloody rampage in the final minutes of Taxi Driver. There's no question that the metropolis has curdled its share of souls. But there's a flip side to this fact. Isolation, rootlessness, anonymity, the negative connotations of these are obvious, but they are not necessarily bad. Similarly, the close bonds you find in small communities, though they may provide stability, are not necessarily good. The ties in communities like that can be tight to the point of suffocating, as I'm sure many of you know. The roots people have there can be restrictive to the point of paralysis. In this case, rootlessness might be longed for. Anonymity might feel like liberation, isolation like relief. For the same reasons that a city can be alienating, it can also be a site of freedom. For Baudelaire's Flaneur, the loss of self is not agony, but ecstasy. He becomes a kaleidoscope gifted with consciousness in an immense reservoir of electrical energy. Even Simmel acknowledges that the metropolis assures the individual of a type and degree of personal freedom to which there is no analogy in other circumstances. This is another reason cyberpunk comforts me. The cities of cyberpunk are fantasy zones where the responsibilities of everyday life, the expectations of relationships and community, are absent. There are no true friends there, just brief acquaintances who pass in and out of your life according to their use. Case, the protagonist of Neuromancer, has no family to speak of, neither does any of his associates. Rick Deckard is much the same, friendless and familyless, until he meets Rachel, that is. Like a million other lost souls in a million other Hollywood movies, their salvation from this alienated universe is each other. Case has no such luck. His romances are purely sexual, affairs of self-interest, fading as they begin. You may think, reading this, that I'd like to abandon all my relationships and disappear into the sprawl. Let me reassure my wife, family, and friends before I start getting concerned calls. That is not the case. Deep relationships are the only lasting source of happiness, in my opinion. And along with some meaningful work and pastries, all I really need. What's more, if I actually were to be transported into Blade Runner's world, I'd probably beg to return to my life within a few days, if not hours. Fantasies of escape are laughably superficial. Under the gentlest pressure, they collapse. Chase after them, and they retreat. If somehow you attain the fantasy, it dissipates or changes aspect. You desired desiring them, you discover, not the thing itself. Life is not a zero-sum game between the freedoms of isolation and the stability of relationships, but there is some sacrifice of one for the other. I'm married, involved with my friends, close with my parents. I wouldn't change that, but it does mean I forego some freedoms. I can't vanish for a week and not tell anyone. I can barely go that long without calling my mom. In certain ways, we're all limited by the people in our networks, by their image of us, their expectations, their needs. In the last decade, I've learned just how much the benefits of good relationships outweigh their drawbacks. Yet it doesn't surprise me that I sometimes fantasize about life without these limitations, that I want it both ways. For me, the city has always been the locus of this fantasy, the cyberpunk city, its purest distillation. As dystopias go, cyberpunk is unique. The Los Angeles of Blade Runner may be a grim place in theory, filthy, harsh, sharply stratified, but Ridley Scott's camera suffuses it with lyricism. Even scenes of violence, like the one in which Deckard shoots down the replicant Zora in the street, are intensely poetic. Zora crashes through shop windows as Deckard's bullet shatters her shoulder. She cries out, then falls in slow motion, shards of glass raining over her. Vangelis' synthesizers echo. With failing strength, Zora manages to rise, only to be pierced by a second bullet, launching her through a retail display of gently falling snow. Momentum carries her into the street, where she collapses onto a bed of shattered mirrors that reflect the multicolored neon of an indifferent city. It's an unforgettable sequence of images in a film full of them. Scott and his collaborators render their dystopia as dream world. The movie has a hypnotic pace, an elegiac tone. Its narrative is subordinate to the mise-en-scène, which is not to say the story is unimportant, only that the movie's aesthetic experience is emotional in itself. Blade Runner is a romantic work of art, in other words, or dark romantic in the tradition of Edgar Allan Poe and noir. As poet April Bernard said, noir is romanticism embittered. The life of feeling that has been betrayed leads to the attitude and genre of noir. No one who loves noir is a cynic. Cynics never believed in anything in the first place. People who love noir are disillusioned romantics. Blade Runner makes beautiful the tragedy of its future. And that beauty invites the viewer. It creates an ideal container for escapist fantasies about the metropolis. Using different tools like the collage technique I described earlier, literary cyberpunk achieves its own kind of lyricism. Like Blade Runner's LA, its settings are grimy yet dazzling, brutal yet attractive. Most of all, they're cool. Where does cool come from if not the underground world of pop culture, which was baked into cyberpunk's DNA from the start? The novels explore these subcultures more extensively than cyberpunk films do. Their characters are stranger and more diverse, more representative of the visionary fluidity Sterling describes. In these scrambled futures, traditional categories of identification get scrambled too. So if you're someone who feels hemmed in by labels, not quite captured by the in-groups of this reality, cyberpunk might offer an escape, a place where you can construct an identity like a cyberpunk hacker retrofits her body with machine parts. This is what Donna Haraway hopes in her seminal essay, A Cyborg Manifesto, from 1985. For Haraway, the cyborg represents a possible escape from binaries of gender and sexuality toward more dynamic forms of identity creation, toward pleasure in the confusion of boundaries. How well cyberpunk made good on that potential is up for debate, but the idea has been a draw for many of its readers and viewers. It still is. Look, for example, at the extreme customizability in Cyberpunk 2077's character creator. When constructing your avatar, you can mix and match traits from across the gender spectrum, with no requirement to choose a sex at the outset. Earlier in development, the game did force that choice, but the designers removed it after feedback from those who wanted to play as characters who reflected their own fluid and visionary selves. The asphalt of cyberpunk is fertile for escapes. From the fragmenting pressures of modern culture, from the stifling expectations of relationships, from reductive categories of identification. While it's an environment ravaged by exploitation and crime and inequality, it's also a massive sandbox of possibility and freedom and fun. Decades ago, cyberpunk may have mounted an effective critique against cultural and political trends, but its writers and filmmakers made their dystopias too enchanting. As we get further from the 1980s, the critique loses